From Iowa Public Radio News, this is Talk of Iowa. I'm Janine Beck. It's Wednesday, and as usual, our focus is on politics. Former Governor Terry Branstad will announce his running mate this week ahead of the Republican state convention on Saturday. Will his selection help or hurt his campaign? Or does it even matter? How much stock do Iowans really put into the lieutenant governor selection? Also, some Republicans suggest a handful of gubernatorial races across the Midwest may be a harbinger of President Obama's re-election chances in 2012. We'll ask our political experts to weigh in. And finally, will conservative Blue Dog Democrats like Leonard Boswell hold more or less power after the next election? We'll get your thoughts coming up this hour on Talk of Iowa. But first, the news. Good morning. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Janine Beck, and it's Politics Day. My guests are Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Iowa, Bruce Gronbeck, and New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson. Thanks for joining us this morning. Are you both there?
Thank you.
Oh, good. I can hear you now. I think we're having just a little bit of technical difficulty, but let's get into the conversation this morning. I want to start with Terry Branstad, who is expected to select a lieutenant governor candidate this week ahead of the Republican state convention on Saturday. And we're expecting to hear that through text message, a new wave of the future. They're going to announce it by text and then hold a press conference. But Branstad has said, and essentially, he's not necessarily looking to balance the ticket. He is going to pick someone who's more like him ideologically, whether it's less of a social conservative, but more of a social moderate and an economic moderate, and said he'll choose someone younger than himself. He's 63. We've heard a lot of names bandied about, Bob Vanderplaats and Rod Roberts, of course, his rivals during the Republican primary. We've heard possibly former Senate President of Ankeny, Jeff Lamberti, and State Representative Linda Upmeyer from Garner. And Bruce, I want to begin with you. Does it matter?
It helps. In one sense, it doesn't matter. But, I mean, you look at the current governor. That Patty Judge was a very good campaigner for Chet Culver to have at his side because, for one thing, her strong agricultural background gave her a natural in this state to the especially for the western half of the state, but not only that. She could not only talk farming and talk agribusiness. Well, but she in fact came with that sense of experience that balanced, the life of a former East Coast football player running for governor back in his home state. So I think it helps. It helps. It's not going to be the crucial difference. I don't think it's ever the crucial difference, unless except of course possibly negatively by massive blunders. Branstad. I think from the first signals he gave, one of the first position he ever mentioned is that he'd be looking for somebody who was not in favor of gay marriages, gives you a sense that he is trying to certainly help, as you talked about, the social conservative portion of the electorate, or the so-called values voters, as we learned to call them in 2008. Looking for some shoring up there. I think he's very confident of his ability to run his position as a political moderate and generally an economic conservative. That served him well, and I think it probably will still be his great strength in his campaign.
It has also suggested, Arnie, that he will not necessarily pick a woman this time. The tradition has been over the last couple of decades that the male governor picks a female lieutenant governor. I don't know if there was some sort of sense of gender equity or whatnot. But he said, you know, he doesn't feel obligated to do that, despite having a female lieutenant governor during his first several terms in office. Is that important? Arnie, are you with us?
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
I can. I'm sorry. I don't know what's going on this morning, but go ahead.
Disconnected and connected. Let me just go back because I had to reconnect, and I'm sorry,
okay.
I missed a few minutes. But let me just say something here. I don't think lieutenant governors matter tremendously, but let me remind everyone, this is the potentially first executive decision of a soon-to-be governor. this decision of lieutenant governor begins to frame how the governor is going to approach decision making, what kind of shadow does he want to lay over the state, yada yada yada. So I though it's not important, it kind of is a little bit important, and I do think that's what I mean. And also Terry is in an interesting position because is he the new Terry Branstad? Because in a way now he has to be a governor for today's issues, for today's political climate, for how Iowa perceives itself today, which is perhaps pretty different from what it's like when he was, you know, the former governor, the governor before. So I think this is going to be an interesting decision on his part. Should it be, you know, Van der Plaats? Should it be a female? Should it be, do you want to balance a ticket or do you want to win?
He wants to win. He needs a wrestling coach.
Exactly. He's a wrestling coach, and maybe that's good. He can go down.
He can pick Gibbons, right? Pick him up. Who ran a very good campaign in my part of the state.
Yeah. Right. And it sounds like he's got some of the newness that he's looking for. See, I don't think he's ever going to go and select Van der Plaats. I think that's off the table. Because I don't
think let me ask you about that, Arne,
strengthen the ticket. That doesn't strengthen the ticket for the general election. You don't necessarily want to only unify the party. You want to win in November.
Mm-hmm. And there are some Van der Plaats supporters who told the Des Moines Register they're considering whether they might want to nominate him at the convention on Saturday. You know, it used to be in Iowa that the lieutenant governor ran separately from the governor. And then, you know, in about the early 90s, the governors began selecting or asking for permission basically to nominate their own candidate. And then at the convention, their supporters just went along. But we've seen a couple of in-party fights at the conventions, you know, whether somebody will actually do this and try to nominate Van der Plaats. We won't know till this weekend. But also at the Democratic convention, there was a move afoot to nominate someone else for lieutenant governor there because that they were dissatisfied with Patty Judge. What do you think about that? Bruce, I'll start with you.
I think the Republicans have to be so careful. They went through the 2006 by-election and 2008 election divided. And their division was constantly held up to the media as a reason ultimately to question the candidates who were running for office in both those elections. I think they desperately need to have a unity move. That might point to Van der Plaats, but I think that would be an awful big stretch given what Van der Plaats and Branstad said about each other, and given the kind of coverage they both got, I think that would be an awfully big gap to bridge. I agree with Arne. I don't think he's going to go there.
Oh, he's not going to go. And they have never, of course, you know, the past is not necessarily a prelude to the present because it isn't. Not this year. Everything that was is not is. And they have never denied the nominee the ability to make that choice since 1990. So it would be unusual for them to do it. I think everyone is in a winning mode. They want to win. They don't want to sort of undermine his first, again, executive decision. But I also want to remind people that lieutenant governors do matter. And Janine, I want to just give you a little interesting sidebar. It's 1991. I get a phone call from Lieutenant Governor Howard Dean in Vermont. And he says to me, Arne, I want to endorse you in your race for governor. And I'm going, I know how to break this to you, Howard, but I'm not sure you'll make a difference in my Democratic primary. And then I started giving him grief, and I said, so when are you going to run for governor? You know, I mean, it's time. And he goes, oh, I don't know how Governor Snelling is doing it. The economy is so bad. There are so many problems. A week later, Snelling dropped dead. And I remember sending, you know, Howard a note saying, I was only kidding, you know. This was not important. But I do want to remind people that there are times that this person is going to have to step in. So not only do you want someone that the governor feels comfortable with, but someone that has the same vision as that governor. Because God help us, if something terrible should happen, you want to continue that legacy, and you don't want to see a 180-degree turn. So they do matter. It has happened in the past.
And Arne, I don't think you heard my earlier question because of the technical difficulties, but one of the things I wanted to pose to you was the fact that Branstad has suggested he may not worry about selecting a woman this time. It's become sort of the tradition that these male governors have selected a female lieutenant governor. And, you know, is that good or bad? In one sense, maybe it was elevated women in a role that we weren't necessarily being elevated to. On the other hand, now it's sort of become cliche. So
it's a cliche. I want them elected. Mm-hmm. I hate to break it to you, but somehow elections matter. And for women to be successful, they need to win elections. That's really what it is. To be chosen by someone else to fill the role of is not the same. And I think at some point in time, it feels a little too cliched. I don't want that kind of affirmative action. I want to go into the rough and tumble, and you will have some choices in the state of Iowa whether you want a woman, because you do have a woman. Roxanne is on the ticket, on the Democratic side. Then make that choice, but don't feel like you need to somehow put a woman in that secondary role because it's a feel-good thing. No. Choose the best person that can work the best with you in order to offer leadership, because what Iowa needs right now is really strong, competent leadership, because the economy is so fragile.
And I think there simply aren't on the Republican side the kind of strong, experienced female politicians that Branstad's going to need to help him. I think he could face questions of window dressing. He could face window dressing, reactions. There's nobody, but compared to the other folks that seem to have made that shortlist, they're simply outnumbered and in most cases out experienced.
I would say that some of the strongest female Republican candidates may have left office in recent years, which may have been the real kicker there. But we want to hear from you this morning. Does Branstad's pick affect you? Do you care? Are you hoping for a particular person, a Republican that has appealed to you? Maybe you voted for them in the primary and now you want to see them on the ticket. We want to hear from you this morning, 1-866-780-9100. Again, that number to join our conversation. 1-866-780-9100. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio and Talk of Iowa, and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Iowa, Bruce Gronbeck, and New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson. This is going to come up this Saturday. You don't expect a challenge to Branstad. You think he'll be able to make his selection. But we're seeing, requests from people to nominate, what about like a Rod Roberts, somebody who was also in the race but did not have that negative aspect toward Branstad that maybe Vander Plaats had?
But he also
does
didn't
he bring
have,
anything to the ticket? Because he only garnered 9% of the vote.
That's right. That's why I say he didn't have a lot of positive to bring.
He's not a threat.
He's not a threat. I'd say that. And it, again, doesn't have that same range of experience that a lot of the others do.
Well, you mentioned Jim Gibbons, and I didn't mention him off the top, but of course the third district congressional candidate, he doesn't have a lot of political experience. However, he raised a lot of money. Is that attractive when selecting a candidate?
He raised money, and he finished second in a monstrous horse race. He did all right, and has general name recognition. Whether he got the political creds to help Branstad will come only, it seems to me, when he's vetted. We'll find out only if the party will find out only when he's vetted.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to take your calls. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. This is Iowa Public Radio. I'm Janine Beck, and we're listening to Talk of Iowa this morning. It's Politics Day. My guests are New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Iowa, Bruce Gronbeck. Before the break, we were talking about Terry Branstad's decision and who he will select for a lieutenant governor candidate. And Professor Gronbeck, you suggested that there may not be a strong enough female candidate to select. And that brings me to one of our first callers, Barbara in Des Moines. Barbara, thanks for calling us this morning on Talk of Iowa.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a quick question, which is, what is the Republican Party doing to increase the number of female candidates? I find it embarrassing that my party is not raising a new generation of young women, and I don't see any evidence that that any effort is being made. Is there? Am I missing it?
Well, I certainly
haven't
seen.
Who wants to jump on that one? Good question, Barbara.
Yeah, I agree. I have not seen that kind of grooming that's been going on in a lot of other states, and certainly, yesterday gave us news of a powerful woman rising in South Carolina, or potentially powerful woman, I guess I better say, but yeah. rising in South Carolina when Nikki Haley finally won the Republican governorship nomination. And it's certainly this has certainly been a story that's been bouncing in and out of the national news on the in California, of course, is swamped with them at the top level right now. I think that's a very good question, Barbara, because I've certainly not seen that happening. If I'm not mistaken, we only have one female running on the Republican side for the National House of Representatives race, Miller Meeks running in the second district against Dave Lopsek.
And we have the Attorney General candidate, Brenna Findley.
Yeah, mm-hmm. right. But you're right. There, and you know, Miller Meeks picked up experience in the last election. She didn't win, but she ran, I think, a solid campaign, and she'll have a crack at this one. But right.
Bruce,
otherwise,
I do think that if you do see some rising stars nationally, like the potential South Carolina Governor Haley, yeah. if she does win in November, that will have an influence because women have been much more successful on the Democratic side of the ticket. There
right.
has been that history, and so as a result, there's sort of a sense of enthusiasm. You can go to another state and hang. You can go to the Women's Political Caucus and talk to people who've run for governor and attorney general because they've won. And winning matters because it's infectious. And once you see enough people in those positions of authority where you are one of one, like a governor, then it becomes easier for both women in Iowa to begin to identify and to assume that it is their turn, that they are part of this conversation because they see successful women governors on the Republican ticket offering Republican and conservative ideas and being successful at it. It really does make a difference.
And I think,
Arnie, I always wondered if, Iowa has one of only two states who's never elected a woman, obviously, to the U.S. Senate, Congress, or the governor's seat. And I always assumed it might need to be a Republican woman the first time only because of the demographics of the state and that apparent reticence to nominate a woman or to elect a woman that would counterbalance those concerns if Republicans had a candidate. But it doesn't seem to have worked in that case either.
Well, you know, it's interesting because in New Hampshire, which was a traditionally Republican state, it was a Democratic woman that mm-hmm. had to run and win. I mean, that's how it happened. It was the opposite of what perhaps the expectation was because, interestingly enough, women had been the majority leader in this all-Republican legislature. Women had been the president of the Senate in this all-Republican legislature. And yet the
and that's the case
wins,
in Iowa as well. It's been
right,
women,
and the person who
Republican
wins the
women
first
leading.
Time.
That's right.
Exactly. So, you know, look at other states where you've seen how the dynamic changed, and perhaps that's the way it'll happen in Iowa. What Iowa has to now figure out is that are they looking at women and providing them with opportunities. And you know what? It's not about providing women with opportunities. Women, you have to take the opportunity. You have to run the risk. You have to take the chance. Most of the time when the door opens, if you don't walk through, it's your fault. I mean, let's be honest here, and that's part of it. I mean, what we see in South Carolina was a woman who saw a door open, and she had the guts to walk through it, and on paper, she was nothing that the Republican Party necessarily would want, and now she's become the darling of the Republican Party for all the things that she actually is.
Well, I think there's one more factor, which is, you know, on the Democratic side, there's a third of a century of practice outside the political parties. The use of the political caucuses and the women's political caucuses as a tool, the coming of the fundraising mechanisms like Emily's List and other things
right.
like that, these all became ways of politicizing and making activists out of a range of women who were then ready to move into party politics with strength and self-confidence and support. That certainly was happening, right? On the Democratic side, that's the first thing Roxanne Connellan did when she lost her bid, was work that street hard. I think it, in other words, it's not simply the matter of the party; it's a matter of mobilizing a substantial portion of the state's electorate, the majority of the state's electorate.
May I make a recommendation?
Let me just jump in. I want to get Adrian on before we lose him because he has a suggestion on the Republican side for lieutenant governor. Adrian, thanks for calling Talk of Iowa.
Hi, good morning. My suggestion to Governor Branstad would be this, rather than, given the fact that he does have a considerable history in Iowa politics, obviously, is it might be refreshing for him to pull someone who doesn't orbit in the political sphere, someone potentially in the business community. And I think that that would, you know, given the current economics, I mean, it'd be good to have good to have someone who's got some executive background in order to be able to navigate the economic waters. The only question is, could he find somebody who'd be willing to take the hiatus from a business career to do that?
Yeah, and take a significant pay cut. Adrian, any names in mind, or mostly just qualifications that you were looking for there?
Well, it's qualifications. There is somebody who has made some noises in the. I mean, he's got name recognition, and that's Fong.
Christian Fong in Cedar
Fong,
Rapids.
That's mm-hmm. right. I'm not suggesting that he would be the right call. I don't know, you know, a great deal about him, but someone like that who can bring some executive acumen to the table as opposed to just the politics. And I think it would be refreshing for the Republicans to do that. It may seem like, you know, a stuffy old executive, but frankly, you know, in today's economic world, I think that executive ability is something that's probably needed.
As long as it wasn't like, you know, Goldman Sachs or AIG. Remind you about some unsuccessful CEO model.
I'm not suggesting that, but what I am saying is, and this will sort of reveal some of my politics, I mean, I frankly think that the current administration in Washington kind of suffers from a little bit of a lack of that executive ability. I think they're, you know, they certainly have a committed political scheme, and can debate that. But it is an executive position. I mean, you have to execute.
But that's an interesting
balance. Adrian, thanks so much for the call. Well, and I was going to ask you, Arnie, because you mentioned earlier, and we only have about a minute left in this segment, but that, you know, something could happen to the governor. And, you know,
yes.
Governor Tom Vilsack, former Iowa governor, had selected Sally Peterson, essentially from, you know, the non-political world. She was working at Meredith. She was active in autism work because of her son, and yet did not have a political experience. And early on, I think if something had happened to Governor Vilsack, it would have been a bit of a shock for her to assume that role. Now, by the end, 8 years later, she was much more confident and I think would have handled herself well. But when you select someone from outside of the system, do you run that risk?
You absolutely run the risk. But I do want to comment on that, on the last caller, because he does make a really good point. Because you do want to balance a ticket, but not necessarily ideologically balance the ticket. You may want to balance the skill sets. That's what he's saying. He's talking about balancing skill sets. That's a fabulous concept for governors to look at. You don't want your clone. You don't want someone who has the same strengths as you. You want to bring someone who may have the same ideological perspective, but who has a different set of skill sets. And for Branstad, it might be someone who comes in having been the CEO with the kind of, you know, rough and tumble of what's happening in today's economy, because they've lived it, walked it, and had to deal with it. And that would bring a different voice to the table, which might be very useful.
There has been one woman that fits that, by the way, suggested, right? Mary Andringham of the Vermeer Corporation in Pella is one of the possibilities.
That has been suggested. And Matt from Des Moines, I'm sorry, we're not going to get to you, but Matt suggests that Branstad should pick someone like himself more instead of someone that's socially conservative, because he believes they would attract more Democrats that way in the general election.
Agree.
Thanks
totally.
For that call, Matt. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Talk of Iowa. More Politics Day when we return. We hope to hear from you at 1-800-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Janine Beck, and this is Talk of Iowa. It's Politics Day, and my guests are Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Iowa, Bruce Gronbeck, and New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson. Before the break, we were speaking about Terry Branstad's decision that is expected this week to select a lieutenant governor candidate ahead of the state's party convention this weekend. And I wanted to read an interesting email we received from Brian in Cedar Rapids. He says, I would like to see a lieutenant governor that will not support a text message blanket information update that he or she is the selection. I feel given Terry Branstad's age and experience in the newer political technology realm, he is desperate in a situation to connect with the modern mediums. It feels tacky and out of date and a bit unprofessional. I think Facebook, Twitter, and text messaging is good for grassroots projects, but not an official decision as such. And would like to suggest Cynthia McKinney move to Iowa and become the lieutenant governor selection. So, Brian, thanks for that email. You could also Twitter us at IPR Talk if you have suggestions or comments this morning.
I
and, of course,
like
the old-fashioned way. I do, too. The old-fashioned way.
I love it because,
way.
You know what? It's almost like, well, it's. I'll never forget once Jerry Brown came to visit our house once he was running for president, and since he was coming to the North Country of New Hampshire, he put on, like, a plaid wool shirt and a turtleneck. And I looked at him, and I said, you're running for what? Like, dress like you're running for president. Take off that outfit. I'm embarrassed for you. So I think it's right. It's not professional. It's not respectful. It has a different feel, but not the right feel.
You know, Arnie, one of the biggest criticisms of reporters here in Iowa, including myself, is near the end of the campaign when Obama was running and came back to Iowa. This is after winning the caucuses, and he came back in the summer, and they held an event downtown right in front of one of our newer buildings that's quite attractive, and they put up hay bales. And we said, it just looked ridiculous. You know, if you're on a farm, fine. Maybe there's some hay around. But in downtown Des Moines, we don't have hay bales out, and it seemed ludicrous to us. That you have to, like you said,
pandering.
Wear the plaid shirt because you're on a form. It's exactly. And Professor Gronbeck, you've seen that for years, of course. And this kind of way of sort of trying to seem relevant that makes you sometimes seem unrelevant.
Well, I mean but that's a standard of American politics, and it seems to me it always had. Whether it's southern politicians running with big red suspenders over bloony white shirts, or the dressing up in Louisiana for the city of New Orleans to dress appropriately, cowboy outfits in the West, bib overalls. I mean, remember Lamar Alexander ran for president here in a plaid shirt the entire campaign.
Yeah.
Got him nowhere, but he tried. I think trying in some any way you can to achieve a sort of identification, even back to Richard Nixon's I was a farm boy myself, which was a stunning sort of thing from somebody from Whittier, California, those sorts of appeals are part of identification. The problem is, that one, we go further and further election by election, and two, with 24/7 news, you're constantly being shown doing this, and I think it makes the performance of your campaign important, and that's where it seems to be the pandering charge comes in.
With the 24-hour news, Arnie, we're doing tweeting. We don't send out text messages, but maybe the campaign felt like, look, there are news organizations that the minute we do announce are going to tweet this, are going to text message it. Why don't we be the sender of that information instead of the news outlet?
And so I'll mug myself because Rolling Stone is lamenting the fact that they didn't even act on their biggest story, which is about McChrystal. Here is Rolling Stone. They were online. They should have had an opportunity. They could have rolled out the story, and they even lost their own lead. I mean, because they were not as au courant as they needed to be. And you're absolutely right. But the problem is that, again, it doesn't fit. It's not his suit. It doesn't fit Branstad to do this. It might be what someone would do, but it's not necessarily what he would do. And you have to do what makes sense for you, the candidate. And last but not least, we were talking about whether he should appoint a woman as lieutenant governor. I'm going to recommend that people read this article, not because they're going to enjoy it, but they should at least know some of the facts. There's an article in the Atlantic Monthly, July-August. It's entitled The End of Men. No, it's by Hannah Rosen, and maybe Terry should read it too, because not only do we know now that women have become the majority of the workforce for the first time in U.S. history, but this is going to blow your mind, most managers in America today are women too. I didn't say CEOs. I didn't say senior vice presidents, but most managers are now women too. So there is clearly a shift, and then the question is how to comprehend that shift and then how to appeal to that shift.
I want to move on to another story that caught my attention this week that I believe relates to Iowa and our gubernatorial race in a broader picture. It was in the Washington Post. It talks about five governor's races that could indicate GOP success in 2012. It says the roots of a Republican political renaissance lie in the Rust Belt, that swath of manufacturing based in states in the Midwest like Illinois, Ohio, Wisconsin, Michigan, maybe even Pennsylvania, where there's been economic difficulties the last few years. It says each state is hosting a competitive gubernatorial race this fall. Republicans argue that a clean sweep or close to it would immediately change the electoral calculus heading into the nationwide redistricting in 2011, which would impact President Obama's reelection race in 2012. They don't mention Iowa, but frankly, you know, we're in this swath. Our economy hasn't been as bad as some of these states that are listed. But let me start with you, Professor Gronbeck. Would a Republican sweep or close to it in those states hurt Obama?
Well, it's certainly not going to do him any good. And you're, you know, that whole range, including Iowa, is that collection of Midwest swing states. The fact that those five governors that they mention are Democratic is important, yes. But, of course, 10 years ago, they were Republican.
Exactly.
Right.
It was and it was an
Ohio,
unpopular presidency
Michigan,
then.
Republican. And yeah. So those states are bounce back and forth, trying desperately to find something that will work locally for them. So, yeah, I would assume they're in trouble because of the very nature of those states. And of course, the Rust Belt economy is constantly forcing the citizens to look for some voice that is talking some kind of vision that they think may get them out of the trouble they're in.
Yeah, but
Jenny, you're close to Pennsylvania, or closer than we are, at least.
Yeah.
What do you think? Do you think that this could have an impact, or is it the normal 2 years into a presidency, things look bad,
redistricting. They were talking about the redistricting. That was what was – and so I think the subtitle should have been Gerrymandering Matters.
Right.
Which Iowa doesn't have.
Which Iowa – that's my point. Which Iowa doesn't have. And again, Iowa is, of all the states, it is the celebration of the most fair way to approach redistricting. That is not the case in all those other five states. And so you don't necessarily want to be lumped with them, because it isn't just about a Republican governor, which would be an indication that obviously there's tremendous dissatisfaction, and especially in places like Michigan. I mean, nobody's happy. Nobody could fix Michigan. I don't care whether you're Jesus Christ, you couldn't fix Michigan. But the point of this story isn't just about Republican governors. But what do Republican governors sweep in with them? But they probably also sweep in a Republican legislature, and as a result, they will be able to play with the fault lines that will decide where those congressional districts are. And if we're already more hardened to assume that districts are, you know, conventionally Republican or Democrat, it's going to get worse. And that's really what this is about. That's not necessarily good for democracy, but it is a reality of how we set those districts, and most of those states are going to lose representation. So they're going to be even more concerned about what those new districts look like and whether they can be predictably Republican or predictably Democrat.
Professor Gronbeck, I wish I had some history on this, and maybe you can help me out here. But, you know, Iowa stands alone and often is touted as such. A former Congressman Jim Leach was just back in the state last week and talked about Iowa's every 10-year redistricting system and how we're this shining, you know, beacon of light in the nation because we do it by computerized maps and the parties voted up or down. And, you know, there isn't gerrymandering. There isn't rigging the system, so to speak, for their own advantage. How did Iowa happen to get that approved? And now states, you know, with political parties looking out for themselves, usually won't move to that kind of system.
You're going to have this. I may be wrong on this. I think the system comes in the late 60s after there's a revolution in the political revolution of 64 that turned Iowa's congressional district around, changed the governorship, and began finally the demise of the great national conservative voices of Miller and Hickenlooper. That in the wake of all that, as well as some things going up on the northern border, and I think this is, but I'm not positive about it, the move toward a judicial oversight of redistricting and a command that it be as fair as possible, which then sooner or later leads to the computerized redistricting. And, of course, Iowa then gets celebrated after the 2000 redistricting by the fact that every district was within 25 votes of every other district, an utterly amazing fact. That then I think, really cemented the system in. What I don't know is when the actual computerized redistricting began to take place.
But we, you know, how everybody wants compromise and they want people to reach across the aisle. We have created a political system that makes it impossible. That
right.
makes it impossible. And with the new refined gerrymandering where, you know, districts look like snakes as opposed to anything else, you recognize that it's really undermining and eroding democracy. That's not what a district was supposed to be. It wasn't supposed to be a guarantee of a party election. It was supposed to reflect what people in a community that are connected together, that have some Velcro that holds them together, decide about what they want for their political future. It is so sad, and that's why, you know, you are celebrated. The sad thing is,
but nobody
everybody
follows
wants
us.
To be like you, but they can't.
Yeah, but they don't do it.
We're also so much smaller than the places we're talking about in this election.
Yes.
Makes it a lot easier, a lot easier.
Yep.
Let me move to another issue. And again, I want to invite you to join our conversation today. If you're interested in what's going on in Iowa politics and want to weigh in, give us a call at 1-866-780-9100. There was a story in the Idaho Statesman that talks about Representative Walt Minnick and how he could help oust House Speaker Nancy Pelosi if so-called blue dog Democrats, more conservative Democrats, fare well in this next election cycle. Arnie, let me just begin with you. Do you expect, first of all, blue dog Democrats, including Iowa Congressman Leonard Boswell, to do well in the fall? They are more conservative. Will that suit them? Or the fact that so many of them were pushed to support things like the bailout and,
the
tarp. Will they actually be hurt because the very things that got them elected, those more conservative fiscal policies, they may be abandoned in the last couple of years?
Well, you know, I mean, there could be another spill because now the moratorium has been lifted. So who knows what that's going to mean? I mean, it is so difficult to predict the mindset of the electorate in November because we are on an incredible, incredible roller coaster. I mean, if you look at just yesterday's news cycle, it should have happened over the course of a year, and it happened in 24 hours. So I understand what the prediction is, but at the same time, you don't know what people are going to be thinking as they walk into the voting booth, because a new group of people have gotten excited about this election. For example, what's happening with Arizona with the law about undocumented workers has got a large community of Hispanics suddenly awake and political in a way they never, never imagined. You're looking at unemployed. There was an article that was just referring to the unemployed as the undeserved unemployed. So for those of you who think you really should not have gotten that pink slip, and that, you know, that it's really an okay thing that you're, you know, collecting unemployment checks, you really are the undeserving unemployed. And in certain states and in certain places, that's going to get people motivated. What do you mean I'm undeserving? I didn't ask for this pink slip after working for someplace for 20 years. So I think that's part of the problem with these stories, is that these stories are going to play out very differently in every single state. And, you know, 2 weeks before the election, the state of the economy in Iowa will be the best predictor of what happens in that election in November.
And
let me
and I
ask
think
our
the,
listeners, Bruce, I want to get to you, but let me just put this question to
ahead.
The listeners out there, and then I'll go to you. But what's motivating you as you head to the polls in November? And maybe it's too soon to know. Your opinion might change three or four times by then. But as you look at the issues right now, what is motivating you? And have you been somebody who's voted every election cycle, or have you sat a couple out? We want to hear from you this morning. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can call us if you're doing things the old-fashioned way. We appreciate it. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Okay, Professor Gronbach, go ahead. What do you think? Blue Dog Democrats, would they even dare to get rid of Nancy Pelosi?
that was an interesting story that a former supporter of hers who'd endorsed her was being asked to consider trying to take her out. I think you're going to get political talk like this all the time. Locally, in my district, I live in the 3rd district. You know, Boswell has in fact behaved like a blue dog Democrat, though he's been moving around a little bit. I mean, he came out strongly, for example, for the health care reform packages, and was not on the opposition side on TARP stimulus spending and so on. So he is, and he's been able to pitch those votes as good for Iowa, and more actively than he's really worked in a long time. He obviously is a bit scared. But I think the bottom line for me is that we've tended, especially in big elections, to think that somehow the values issues, that voters don't understand all the complex issues, so they vote for things like whether they're for or against publicly funded abortions or gun control and on and on. The so-called red hot button issues, because they can understand them. I don't know about those other things, but I know what's right or wrong. I think right now we're going to face a very interesting election, because the substantial issues of what to do about the economy, what to do about a war, what to do about immigration, where there are not easy answers at all. They are extremely – the poll that shows Americans both want to develop alternative energy, but at the same time want to keep deep water drilling going. You know, that they want both sides, and it's frustrating. Those kinds of – and the same is true of immigration. You can't throw out millions of people. A wall won't just keep the world out, and yet you're you want to do something about the issue that – these issues are going to matter in this election, although I agree with Arnie that the bottom line is still going to be how I feel about the economic basis of the way I live day to day.
And it is so confusing, because you have, for example, the federal court, throwing out Barack Obama's 6-month moratorium, and you have, the governor of Louisiana praising that decision. You're going, wait a minute, all that mess is happening on your shore. You're happy that they're lifting the moratorium,
and then you find out. So it comes down to money for them.
It's about money. It's about jobs. It's about all those things.
Yep.
And there's such confusion, because the reaction you expect is not the reaction you're getting. And that means that we have to know more about those parts of the country and how they get their jobs and what kind of income they're producing. But you know what? We haven't really educated ourselves for a long time. And this is such a challenging economy that it's going to require a much more sophisticated, nuanced response. But who is preparing us for that? No one.
And I think you go back to the great Tip O'Neill, all politics is local. You can talk about the national image, the national public sphere talk and all that stuff. But when it still comes down to what's going on locally. So the immigration issue hits Iowa hard when we close a packing plant or two and do some arrests and now have an amazing court decision this week. Then it begins to affect you where you sit. And I think the same is going to be true. The war issue comes down to a perception of what's happening to the Iowa boys stories that would come flooding back in some of the other military operations of the 90s, and the same is going to be true of the energy sort of question. Energy is is big, not because of oil drilling in Iowa, but because of alternative fuels and biofuels. So if whoever can shape those national issues inside localist configurations, I think is going to have a good chance to take the state.
Well, let me ask you, Professor Gronbach, you mentioned, the war and the continuation, and Iowa is poised to send close to 3,000
right.
Iowa National Guard men and women to Afghanistan, probably in the fall. They haven't heard exactly the timeline, but that's what it looks like at this point. They're in training right now. That's so close to the election that would that have a surge of support, in the sense that there's a feeling of support for the military, a feeling of we can turn this around? Or that being that close to the election, does that sour Iowans as they see, friends and family going overseas?
How does that play?
Since Iowa
doesn't have this kind of, it seems to me, for near as I can tell, the same number of their National Guards personnel and so on who are on their third, fourth, or in some cases even fifth tour, they haven't been put – we tend to have more – often many of our units are more specialized and haven't had those same kinds of rotations. But
There have been a pretty heavy rotation, though. There are many on their second and third.
There are. I agree. Yeah.
Janine, but it seems to me, volunteer military, Once you have a volunteer military, the ability to bring those stories as close to home as we need to makes it that much difficult. They made a choice. They choose to serve. Families grieve when they lose them. I think this war in Afghanistan is so off the burner because of the Gulf. It's so off the burner because of job losses. Thank God for Rolling Stone. I mean, if it wasn't for Rolling Stone, we wouldn't even be talking about Afghanistan because it has so left the headlines.
And we talk about it now in these peripheral ways of who said what to who, not about whether things are working on the ground, whether we're making a difference, whether we're seeing the kind of results that McChrystal wanted. I mean, that's, you know, advocated for.
It's such a difficult place to deal with right now. And again, there are so many side stories here. I mean, the fact that we know that it's producing, you know, more heroin and more poppies than any other country in the world now and supplying our addiction. What people don't know is yet, maybe supplying the addiction of the world, it's now also seeing huge increases in addiction in Afghanistan. So not only are the Afghanis growing this stuff, but now they're seeing a rise in their own addiction levels. The Taliban might have done only one thing right, and the one thing they did was eliminate the growth of poppies completely. Well, now they're back. Now they're producing most of the revenue for the country, but now it is not only addicting Western youth, it is addicting Afghans. Oh, my God, you got to put that into the tragedy of Afghanistan as you try to decide how to win.
I think you put the Iowa troop deployment, interestingly, will be happening right around the time we're due for the national reevaluation or evaluation of where we are in Afghanistan.
Yep.
In the fall, and that is going to color, it seems to me, the understanding of the local effect, but also then what the talk is locally inside the state of Iowa about that reevaluation, I think, may again have an effect on the election.
All right. Professor Gronbeck, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Iowa, Bruce Gronbeck, thank you so much for your time today. Greatly appreciate it.
A pleasure.
New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson, thanks for being with us, Arnie.
It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to Talk of Iowa, produced by Dennis Reese and Catherine Perkins. Podcasting and on-demand audio is available at iowapublicradio.org. And remember, we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Theme music composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Janine Beck. Thanks for listening.
I'm Ben Kiefer. Wednesday on The Exchange, we...